I want to thank you all for joining the second leg of our legal holiday Shiurim series. Of course, last time we had the privilege of hearing from Rabbi Arya Leibowitz and Rabbi Eli Belzon, and this morning we have the immense privilege of hearing from Shai Schechter. I want to begin by thanking our Shiurim sponsors, Jennifer and Ronnie Aronoff, Sheila and Ronnie Apfel, Amy and Daniel Gipper, Dina and Saul Kazovitz, in commemoration of the yahrzeit of Dina's father, Avi Blumenfeld, Avram Yosef, and Yisrael Shalom, Alba Shalom, Mindy and Henry Orlinsky, Zivia and Yosef Rubin, in commemoration of the first yahrzeit of Yosef's mother, Bela Bas Yosef Yehuda Zepharla Rapa, Chamla and Danny Sachs, Naomi and Kenny Schiff, Lani and Shimi Tenenbaum, and Aviva and Avi Bogler. In introducing our speaker this morning, it would be easy to just read a list of Rabbi Schechter's many accolades and accomplishments. I think many of us have heard Rabbi Schechter before in one capacity or another, or at least know by reputation of his immense Torah knowledge and wisdom, his clarity and eloquence in teaching and presenting words of Torah, and his ability not just to teach, but also to inspire. But rather than just reading a list, I leave that to you. Everybody has a copy of this past week's bulletin where you can find that list of accolades and accomplishments. I will instead offer a brief note of introduction that speaks both to the topic that we will be learning this morning and also to my personal appreciation for Rabbi Schechter and his accomplishments. This morning we're going to talk about considerations pertaining to visiting the Har HaBayis. One of the major halakhic considerations in that discussion pertains to the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. And Chazal described two junctures in Jewish history in which there was an added sanctification of Eretz Yisrael. What Chazal called Kedusha Rishona and Kedusha Shnia. There was one point of added sanctification that occurred in the times of Yoshua ben Nun, at the times when the Bnei Yisrael first entered Eretz Yisrael, and that was a sanctification that was occurred through a process of kibush. There was a war of conquest led by Yoshua, by Othniel ben Kenaz, the first of the Shoftim, and other great figures who conquered the land of Eretz Yisrael and imbued it with a certain extra level of sanctity. Then there was a second one later on that occurred after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, 70 years after the Korban Bayis Rishon. The Jews returned to Eretz Yisrael in the process of Shivat Zion, and that second sanctification occurred through Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael. There was no war of conquest at that point. It was merely the process of returning to Eretz Yisrael and settling in the land that added that a level of sanctity and Kedusha to the land itself. And there are a number of differences between this Kedusha Rishona and Kedusha Shnia through the process of Kibush of conquest and Yishuv and settling the land that occurred the second time around, but I'd just like to highlight one this morning through a Hashkafic lens. And that is that Kibush, the process of sanctification that occurred the first time around, is a top-down process. It's led by certain dynamic figures, again, Yoshua and the early Shoftim. They were the ones who led the process and led the Bnei Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael, and it was through their leadership that the land was sanctified. Yishuv, by contrast, is in a certain sense a bottom-up process. Everyone takes an equal part in just settling the land and doing their small part to take a chelek of Eretz Yisrael and to settle there. And when we view those two episodes, or through those two processes of sanctification through that lens, I think it's quite fitting and proper that the first one occurred through Kibush, while the second occurred through Yishuv. Very often, the first time around, it's difficult for these bottom-up types of processes to work. As much as there's perhaps added value to Yishuv, and that process of sanctification that occurs through everyone just doing their part, everyone being involved in sanctity in matters of Kedusha, at the outset, you need dynamic figures who are going to lead the way. It's very hard for us, the average Jew, to just take up the charge on our own and lead the process of sanctification that occurs in Eretz Yisrael, or in a broader sense, in the world of Torah and Mitzvot. We need people that we can look to as leaders, as guides, people who are going to blaze the trail, who are going to be vanguards in creating that process of sanctification. And once that's done, then you pave the way for a Kedusha Shnia. Then you have a moment when everyone can equally take part in the yeshiva of Eretz Yisrael, or yeshiva in the Ohel Shel Torah, or settling any process of sanctification of Kedusha that may exist, whether it be in the narrow historical context of each of Eretz Yisrael, or in the broader context of pursuing Kedusha today. But it starts with those leaders who are indeed blazing the trail, who are providing a model for the rest of us to follow. And in introducing Rabbi Schechter, I could say that there's definitely a personal element to this introduction. Rabbi Schechter, as much as he is a teacher of Torah throughout the Jewish world, has most recently made his home in my hometown, in Woodmere, and he has made his imprint on the shul that I grew up in the Young Israel of Woodmere. And I can tell you, viewing the growth of the community, both internally and from afar, There have been such tremendous strides due to the leadership that he has provided and the model that he has set. And it's really inspiring to observe. It's an inspiring model to attempt to follow. And it's a remarkable privilege for us to have that kind of leadership in Klal Yisrael at large and to be teaching us Torah this morning. So without further ado,
thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Rabbi Schreier. It's such a pleasure to be here. The last time I was here was to celebrate your installation. So, Baruch Hashem, I'm happy to come back to this shul for happy things, and we should continue to do so. Mechayil El Chayil. Rabbi Schreier mentioned about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, the Kibush Haaretz, which really makes us think about our Geula, which makes us remind ourselves of what Yeshua will look like. The topic that I chose for this morning is something that is very much on my mind. I hope it's on many of our minds. Unfortunately, I just had to cancel my fourth attempt to go to Eretz Yisrael in the past year or so. And it's very disheartening. It's very upsetting. It's concerning. It's something that should make Eretz Yisrael really be on the forefront of all of our minds. You know, COVID has been a gzeira ra min ha-shamayim. It has been a terribly awful gzeira on all of us, and it has impacted our lives in so many different ways, in so many devastating ways. And I think sometimes what we maybe do not give enough attention to in this gzeira is the fact that we've been shut out from Eretz Yisrael. And it's something that, at least for my generation, is a dream that we never thought would actually come true in our lives. We never thought there would be a time when we would not be allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael. And it's painful, it's difficult. It's hard to understand how this is part of the story of the Jewish people. How can this be? But I'm reminded of a comment of the Netziv, commenting on a pasuk in this week's Parsha. So Moshe Rabbeinu was singled out to be the leader of the Jewish people. And the Medrash tells us that he puts up a very fierce opposition to his being chosen. And he tries everything he can to get himself out of this job. He really does not want to be the one to be in charge of the Jewish people for a variety of reasons, but mostly because Moshe Rabbeinu is Anav Mikal Adam. Moshe Rabbeinu is such a humble human being, and he does not want to take the mantle of leadership upon himself. And as he's negotiating with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at one point he turns to them and he says, "V'hein lo yaminu li v'lo yishmu b'koli." They're not going to listen to me, because they're going to say ki yomru, because they collectively will say, "Lo nirai lecha Hashem." There is no way that God has appeared to you. Now ask the Netziv, maybe you want to say, "I'm not a politician." Maybe you'll say, "I don't know how to lead." Maybe you'll say, "I'm not a good orator. I don't know how to speak. I don't know how to present myself." All of that makes sense. But how can you claim the Jewish people are not going to believe that you were singled out by HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Why do you think that? Why would anybody doubt the fact that you were chosen? The Netziv explains that in every generation, when we think about the prospect of Geula, the Netziv writes, there are people who have an image in their mind of what Geula is supposed to look like. Let's face it. You know, I just said over Shabbos, actually, I always knew that my father was a great man, is a great man, but as I get older, I realize more and more about him that I never was familiar with beforehand. So, as I'm getting older, I'm starting to get a little bit of the Yerusha of my father, not monetarily, but the Yerusha of a lot of the Mishigoyim in his life have come to me, and I'm very shocked, as I'm coming to meet a lot of them, that my father has sat over years and years and just sat patiently giving these people time. So there are a number of them who claim to be Mashiach and who claim to be Eliyahu HaNavi and who feel it is absolutely critical that they need to reveal themselves as soon as possible. I'm not exaggerating at all. And it's very hard to get in touch with my father, so why not call his son, because this is an emergency. So I have these conversations every so often with individuals who are very close with my father and who usually pour their hearts out to him about how devastating it is that they can't reveal themselves. And I'm sitting and listening to this and I'm wondering, you know, I would love it if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would send us a Geula and Mashiach and Eliyahu HaNavi, but I can assure you it's not going to be you. And everybody in their own mind has an image of who they think Mashiach is going to look like. What's that experience going to be? We all have a fascination with the end of days. What's that going to feel like? What's that experience going to be like for all of us? And says the Netziv, there are certain people that we've certainly ruled out. And the Netziv writes, in the 1800s, there were many who said, You believe in the Shivas Zion movement. You believe that we're going to come back to Eretz Yisrael. And the ones who are going to lead the charge are a bunch of atheists, a bunch of people who aren't Shomrei Shabbos, who don't keep kosher, who don't believe in God. They're going to be the ones. It's impossible. They're going to be involved in our coming back to Eretz Yisrael. That cannot be. It's not in line with the image, with the vision of what we feel Mashiach's coming is going to look like. And writes in Netziv, it is the same claim that Jews have had in every generation. And that is what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying. Jewish people are going to look at me and say, after all, he's an Ish Mitzri. He grew up in the palace of Paro. He ran away. He was not involved in the Shibud Mitzrayim. He hasn't been around for years. Nobody knows who he is. You look at him, he doesn't even look like a Jew. After all, the daughters of Yisrael refer to him as an Ish Mitzri. They don't believe that he's really a Jew at all. He's going to be the one to bring us the Geula? It's impossible. Ki Yomru. Because people will say, Lo nira elecha Hashem. We believe that there will be a Geula, but it's not going to be from you. You're certainly not going to be the person who will bring us that redemption and that salvation. And the Netziv writes that sometimes we need to take a step back and allow the Ribono Shel Olam to let the Geula happen. So how is this stage a part of our redemption? I don't know. How could it be that part of the process of Reishis Tzmichas Geula Seinu is that all of us in Chutz Laaretz are being shut out for years, that we don't have the opportunity to go and visit and be a part of the experience in Eretz Yisrael? I don't know. You'll ask yourself, maybe we're going backwards, maybe we're going in the wrong direction, maybe. I don't know. But we need to remember that this was a claim, writes the Netziv, that every generation of Jews have had and have continued to doubt themselves about. How is it possible that this is all a part of the bigger story, of the larger story of Geula, when it seems that the narrative is going in the opposite direction and not at all the way that we envisioned or imagined the Geula looking? So for that theme in mind, I thought it was an opportunity for us to talk about a topic that I'm sure many of us have thought about, have heard about before, but it's an opportunity to look into it from the sources and really understand what this issue is all about. So let's begin with what I believe is just such a poetic, such a passionate description that Rabbi Avadia Yosef writes in one of his tshuvas. And all of Rabbi Avadia's tshuvas are beautiful, but here in the Abiya Omer, he's writing, just notice, it's Gimel Sivan Tafshin Chav Zayin. So I wrote the English date, it's 1967. Chav Ches Iyar was Yom Yerushalayim. 1967 on Chav Ches Iyar was the day that the Jewish army, that the Jewish community, the Jewish people, had the great gift of getting Yerushalayim back into their own control. That was Chav Ches Iyar, and here we are, Gimel Sivan, just a few days later, and the religious community is having a major discussion. What do we do now? In fact, I once read in Rav Goren's autobiography, I don't know if anyone's read it before, but it's amazing. If you haven't, it's worth it. He was a fascinating personality in so many different ways. So Rav Goren writes in his autobiography that he remembers in those original days, right after Kibush Yerushalayim, he says that he remembers people had no idea what was what. And people were running through the Harabayas and asking, where's the Kotel? Where's the Kotel? We want to daven. And he was explaining to them, no, you don't understand. The holiest place in all of Judaism is not the Kotel, it's the Harabayas, and you're on it. You should not be running away from here. You shouldn't be here in the first place. But once you're here, don't run through the Harabayas to get to the secondary place. That is not really the masterpiece of where Jewish life is supposed to be. That is not the central focus. And here, Rabbi Avadia explains what was going on in the minds of so many Jews at that time. Let's read it together. He says, "Biyos ki biyamim eile, in these last couple of days, hifli Hashem yizbarach hasada v'nifla osav imanu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has astounded us. We are awestruck over what the Ribono Shel Olam has overwhelmed us with. Gavar aleinu chazda v'ro, kol afsi yaretz his yeshuas elokeinu. All the nations of the world have seen this salvation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has sent us. Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo b'avur shemo agadol." Any of us who have read some of the history or who were alive at the time are well aware of the fact that there were hundreds of thousands of prospective deaths that were expected at the time. There were tens of thousands of graves that were dug in advance of the Six-Day War. And nobody anticipated this outcome. V'yatzanu me'afela liora, miyagon l'simcha. Baruch Hu mevarech shemo, asher sam nafshena b'chayim v'lo nasan namot ragleinu. You know, when I saw this line, we say it every night in Maariv, but it meant so much more to me when you see it in this context. Sam nafshena b'chayim v'lo nasan namot ragleinu, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the opportunity to rebuild ourselves. V'rov rachama v'chasada, with great mercy and kindness. Zachinu gam l'shechuro shel hakotel ha-maravi, srid beis mikdashenu v'tifartenu, v'af kol shetach harabayis v'hamikdash nesunim hema b'chaso shilton Yisrael. Now, the entire harabayis is under Jewish sovereignty, under Jewish control, l'chein, and therefore, amadati v'ezbonim b'dvar machlokes rabbeseinu harishonim. Now he writes, it would be an appropriate time for us to get into a very interesting sugya that really was never relevant, and that is about the discussion of mutar lihikanes bizmanas el makam amigdash v'im yesh lefarsim iser badavar kidei lemnoa michshol mecharedim ledvar Hashem. Everybody wants to do the right thing. Nobody wants to make a mistake. And he says that we have to delve into the sugya, and we don't have a lot of time. We only had 6 days to prepare for this. Who would have ever imagined that this was going to be the outcome? So here we are, trying to figure out what to do. And what's amazing is, if you read the tshuva inside, it's pages and pages and pages long, as all of Rabbi Avadia's tshuvas are. Very extensive tshuva with a tremendous amount of research. I love how he writes, you know, I was caught off guard. I didn't know what to say, and I had this issue. You obviously worked it out a long time ago, because here you are 3 days later, or 5 days later, and you have no problem writing a lengthy tshuva, figuring out exactly what to say, and which rishonim are right, and which are wrong, and how we paskin, and what the mahalach is. You know, I asked my father during COVID. We were on the phone every single night. We had a Zoom call with my father and a number of other rabbanim, my contemporaries, and we were discussing with him all the shadows that were coming in. My father's 80 years old. He couldn't go through hundreds of emails a day. So we were going through all these emails and presenting them to him at night, writing up responsa, and he was writing tshuvas, and we were translating them. It was a very interesting time, and it was just amazing to me how every single question that we presented to him, he did not flinch. He had an answer on the spot for every single thing that we asked. And it was a fully worked out mahalach for everything. And I finally asked him, when did you prepare all of this? These are shilas that nobody's ever looked into, nobody's ever thought about. Like, when did you think about this? And he said, over the last 80 years. Like, this is not, I don't just learn because I need to answer a shila. If you learn for 80 years, then you're going to know the answers to all these questions. It's no problem. And just because it presents itself in a little bit of a different way, this is not a new set of sugyas, this is not a new set of halachas, this is obvious. We've worked this all out. I remember there was a woman from the JTA who wanted to do a interview with my father, and she was very inspired by the tshuvas that she was reading, and I'm not sure if she's Orthodox or not, I don't know exactly, but we were in touch a lot throughout COVID, and she kept asking that she wants to do an interview with my father. I said, you know, he really doesn't do interviews, we don't enjoy these things too much. And she said, no, it's just so inspiring. And she convinced me that it would be a big Kiddush Hashem to do an interview. So like, okay, after a lot of convincing, I finally agreed we're going to do an interview. No problem. So we decided we're first going to do an interview with the younger group of rabbis who were working along with my father. And then after she gets a little bit of an appreciation what it's like to be involved in such things, then she should meet with my father and have a real appreciation for who he is. So fine. So we're doing this whole discussion with her. And she's asking us all these kinds of questions, and she says, you know, what was it like? Like, how did he come to the decision that he should finally go public after all these years of being such a private person, and you know, he's so humble, and all of a sudden he decided that everything he writes should be publicized? I said, you really don't understand who he is. I don't think he has a clue that this stuff is on Facebook and on Twitter and on the internet. Like, he has no idea. She's like, what do you mean? He's following every day. He knows what's going on. There's a marketing team behind this. I said, you really don't know who you're dealing with. Anyway, it was very interesting because she finally was so excited to have the interview with him. And after she gets the interview, she says, she asked him a question I was on. And she says, so, you know, what was it like to get all these novel questions? Can you tell me the most interesting one that you got that you never would have fathomed in a million years? And he's like, I can't think of anything that was new. I don't know. This is all like old stuff that we worked out many, many years ago. It's really not such a big deal. So I find that fascinating. If you're a real Talmud Chacham, when you have a new Shaila and you only have a week to figure it out, you figure it out because it's not something new to you. So Rabbi Avadia here, I just find it fascinating how he says he was stuck and he doesn't know what to do. And we have this new issue that presents itself to the Jewish community and let's try to figure out what to do. And it was all figured out in his head way before. And he just had to apply all of his tremendous knowledge. So just to frame the discussion and that we understand what it is that we're talking about, this is not an issue that is politically charged. I know that some people mentioned to me before, wow, you chose a really hot political topic. It is not a politically charged issue at all. Everybody who's involved in this discussion is l'shem shamayim. There are those who believe that it's the right thing to do, and they're doing so not because they're wild extremists. It's not because they're a bunch of crazy people. I think in Israel they call them Noar HaGvot, something like that. Is that correct? That's not what we're describing here. We're talking about people who believe that this is the right thing to do, l'shem shamayim, because it's the right thing to do. And we're talking about another group of people who feel maybe it's an improper thing to do because not political persuasions are making them feel that way, but because it's just not the right thing to do al pi halacha. That's the discussion that we're going to have. Let's begin by explaining why it is that those who feel this is an important thing to be doing, to go onto the Har HaBayis, to visit the Har HaBayis, whenever the opportunity presents itself, why is it that they feel so passionately about it? Why is it that they feel it's so important for them to be involved in this kind of endeavor? It begins with the comment of the Ramban in the Sefer HaMitzvos, where the Ramban says, we have a pasuk that we're told, "Vehorashtem es ha'aretz." We have an obligation, I forgot to put it on here, but the Ramban says, we have an obligation, "Vehorashtem es ha'aretz, v'yishavtem ba." As Rabbi Schreier mentioned, we have an obligation to do the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, to try and conquer the entire land of Eretz Yisrael. V'yishavtem ba, and explains the Ramban, v'yishavtem ba means not only do we need to conquer the land, but we need to make sure, v'lo na'azvena b'yadzu lasenu. Says the Ramban, we don't have a right to abandon the land. We cannot withdraw our sovereignty. We cannot give up and surrender any part of Eretz Yisrael b'yadzu lasenu. After all, says the Ramban, HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov that we are going to be the ones who are deserving of Eretz Yisrael, and for us to forego our rights to any part of the land is something that is a terrible disgrace to the promise of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to all our forefathers, to the dream of all those who came before us. Now we're able to live that dream, and we're going to abandon a part of what belongs to us because we're just not interested or because we don't feel it's worth the fight. Says the Ramban, this is something that we do not have a right to do. That is reason number one, that we need to show a continuous, ongoing interest, a concern, an enthusiasm, a passion that needs to be there ever presently. It cannot stop once we finish with the Kibush Haaretz. It's something that needs to be an ongoing ordeal for all of us to show our interest and our passion for the love of Eretz Yisrael. Secondly, the reason why this is important is because in Parashas Va'eschanan, the Torah tells us we have an Isser of Lo Sechanim. It's discussed in the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Rambam talks about it, the Mechaber as well, in Yeridei and a number of places, but it's not clear exactly what the Torah means when it says the Isser of Lo Sechanim. What exactly is the Torah getting at? What does the Torah mean to teach us? And the Gemara says that there are three different limudim, three different halachos that we learn from this pasuk. And all of them are equally accepted in Shulchan Aruch. Number one, the Gemara says, Aser Lesaper B'Shivchan Shal Ovdei Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to show an admiration, I guess is the right word, for an Oved Avodah Zarah. So, what does that mean? Does it mean there's never a non-Jew who does something good? Of course that's not what it means. Does it mean we should not take something good from everything we see from people in the world? Of course we should. But to show a certain sense of idolizing to any of those personalities who are Ovdei Avodah Zarah. And unfortunately, I think this is something that we might be able to do a little better in, right? Our children very often are tremendous fans of sports, which is fine. I say our children because I hope at some point we as adults grow out of this. But our children often not just are fans of sports. Sports is wonderful. Sports is healthy. Sports are great. It's a great distraction. It's a great kosher fun. It's great. It's wonderful. But when it goes too far, where we idolize those personalities who are excelling in sports, it's something that borders on this issue. It's exactly what the Shulchan Aruch says, that when you take something too far and you idolize an Oved Avodah Zarah because you value something in their life, it's something that we need to take very, very seriously. And that is learned from the Pasuk of Lo Sechanim. Obviously, the Gemara's point is, if you're going to idolize them in one way, it's going to lead to idolizing them in other ways. And we've seen that. We've seen when sports players get up and give us their feelings and their thoughts about politics that they know nothing about, and they give us their feelings about COVID, which they know nothing about. They're not doctors, they're not lawyers, they're not medical professionals, they're not anything. They're great sports players. Stay in your lane. Do the job that you're supposed to do. But we idolize them, and as a result, we take their opinion seriously about many different things. And that is something that is very troubling and very problematic, and that is exactly what Chazal warned us of from this pasuk of Lo Sechanim. Number two. The Gemara says, and this is also very relevant for this time of year, we are not allowed to give a matnas chinam to an Oved Avodah Zarah. You're not allowed to give a gift to an Oved Avodah Zarah just because. Now, the key word there is a matnas chinam. So if I have a mailman, if I have a garbage collector, if I have somebody who's doing a service for me, if I have somebody who works with me in the office, a colleague, a friend, and we have a relationship that is not a matnas chinam, I give them a gift because I know that we have a relationship, and this gift will further enhance that relationship. And this gift will further enhance their ability to provide for me, my ability to provide for them, our relationship to grow. That is fine. That is not a matnas chinam. The Gemara here just says you're not allowed to give a matnas chinam just out of goodwill. That is not something that we are encouraged to do. And number three, the Gemara says you're not allowed to give them chanaya bekarka. You're not allowed to give an Oved Avodah Zarah an opportunity to live or to buy a home or a property in the land of Israel, which is a major problem this year in particular. Because as we know, there's a lot of controversy about the Heter Mechira. Shemitah is always complicated. And I feel like every 7 years when we get to Shemitah, it only becomes more complicated, not less, somehow. But here we are again in a Shemitah year, and it's a great gift to the Jewish people that we have a Shemitah, but it's complicated. And one of the ways around the problem of Shemitah is to consider the Heter Mechira. Now, if you consider the Heter Mechira, there are many questions about the Heter Mechira, but the major question is, how are we allowed to sell any part of the land of Israel to a non-Jew if, after all, that is a blatant violation of the Isser of Lo Sechanim? We are not allowed to sell any part of the land of Israel to a non-Jew. So that is a major question. It's discussed in the contemporary postgame. There's a lot to say about it. But that is reason number two why there are many who feel we have an obligation to frequent the Har HaBayis, because we cannot show as if we have surrendered our control. We're not allowed to give up and say, we are giving it over to our enemy and we're allowing you to have full and complete sovereignty. There's a prohibition of Lo Sechanim, which means we have an obligation to show that we are in complete and total ownership of every part of the land of Israel. Number three, there is a pasuk where we're told that we should show an interest in the Makom HaMikdash, which means the Torah says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the Makom HaMikdash, l'shichno sidrishu uvas hashama, we should not only have the opportunity to go when we want, but we should express an interest. We should go there. And the Rishonim explained, the Ramban writes on Chumash, Shatel chulo me'eretz marchakim. We should come to visit from all different corners of the globe to show, v'tishalu, I mean, you should ask each other, ana derech beis Hashem, how do we get to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's home? After all, there's a beautiful comment of the Chazon Ish, if I'm not mistaken. He asks, the Torah says in Parshas Maaseh that we have an institution of Ari Miklat. Ari Miklat is a very unfortunate reality when you have a Jew who was a Ritzach B'Shogeg. It was an inadvertent murder, and now we know that his punishment or his tshuva, whatever it's going to be, is that he has to spend some time in the Ari Miklat. When going there, the Torah says, V'nas elachas harim, he has to run to one of those cities. Now, how is he supposed to know where the cities are? The Torah says, someone's trying to do something here. The Torah says that when the person is running to the Ari Miklat, so he is supposed to go to one of the cities that is closest to his home. How is he supposed to know where it is? So Chazal tell us you have to hang up signs to inform that person of where the Ari Miklat is going to be. So the Chazon Ish was asked, why is it that we hang up signs on the way to an Ari Miklat to help out the murderer, and yet we don't hang up signs when it comes to Yerushalayim? Everybody has to be Ola Regal every year. Shalosh Pamim Bashana, Yeroa Kol Zechurcha Espanei Hashem. You have millions of Jews. How many people do you have going to the Ari Miklat? Hopefully it's very few. So for millions of Jews who are getting lost and they don't know where to go, and they ask any Israeli, they're going to tell them, Yashar, Yashar, just keep going, it's fine. They're all going to get lost. And yet when it comes to getting to the Ari Miklat, we make sure that it's very clearly signed, that we know exactly how to get there, everything's marked. Why is there not a sign that is hung up when it comes to Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, Beis HaMikdash? So the Chazon Ish said the reason why is because someone who's going to the Ari Miklat, we want him to go as quickly as possible. We don't want people talking and gossiping about what just happened. Oh, how did the murder happen? And how was the person killed? And how fast was he driving his car? And did they run a stop sign? It's terrible. We don't want people discussing this kind of matter. When somebody's going up to Yerushalayim, let them ask as many people as possible. People are going to ask them, where are you headed? Going to Yerushalayim. Why are you going there? Oh, it happens to be. It's a week before Yom Tov. I want to make sure to get there. I want to buy their karbanos. Oh, you know what? I forgot all about it. I'm also going to get myself together. I also need to start getting my plans in order, because I also need to go up to Eretz Yisrael, to Yerushalayim. And therefore, the Chazon Ish said, we specifically choose not to hang up signs toward the Beis HaMikdash, because we want everyone to encourage their friends. Says the Ramban here, that seems to have been the practice. People would turn to their neighbors, to their friends, and say, oh, where are you headed? Where are you going? It shows an expressed interest. It excites people when they talk about such things. And therefore, L'shichno sidrushu uvas hashama is part of our obligation to be a part of the experience of Har HaBayis, of Makom HaMikdash, not just to own it, not just to have sovereignty, but to be a part of that experience and to be excited about it. Number four, we have a mitzvah to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu wherever we may be in the world. But on top of that, the Rambam writes in the Sefer HaMitzvahs and Mitzvah Hey, which is all about the mitzvah of tefillah. The Rambam qualifies the mitzvah and he says, Avdeu b'taraso, part of the mitzvah of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to serve Him through studying His Torah. Number two, Avdeu b'mikdasho. The Rambam here seems to make up a new kind of mitzvah where he says, we should serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu wherever we are in the world, but there is something special and unique about serving the Ribono Shel Olam in the Makom HaMikdash. That is reason number four. And finally, there is a connection that is drawn in the Torah between Eshabsosai Tishmaru U'Mikdashi Tiro. The Gemara Maseches Yevamos tells us that there is an intrinsic connection. That connection is that even when you're doing something as important as building the Beis HaMikdash, you are not allowed to be Mechal HaShabbos to do so. That is what the Gemara says. But from here, the Gemara also learns, Ma Shmira HaAmura LiOlam, just like we have an obligation to keep Shabbos not only in the times of Beis HaMikdash, not only in Eretz Yisrael, but for eternity, so too, there's a mitzvah of Mora HaMikdash forever, for all eternity, which means, even at a time of Churban Beis HaMikdash, we have a mitzvah of Mora HaMikdash. So some Achronim say, imagine, we have a mitzvah of Kibbut Ava'im and Mora Ava'im. We have a mitzvah to respect our parents. We have a mitzvah to revere our parents. So, you know, I don't want to get involved in the whole thing. It's a very difficult mitzvah. Bless you. We have a very difficult mitzvah here of Kibbut Ava'im, of Mora Ava'im. So, you know what? I don't want to make any mistakes. So, I'm going to move to Australia. This way, I just won't have to deal with the issue. Is that a way of showing respect to my parents? Is that a way of showing Mora to my parents? Because I just don't want to get involved in the problem. I don't want to make a mistake and do the wrong thing. Of course not. That is the most disrespectful way to treat my parents. And some Achronim say, that's maybe what the Torah is getting at here. The same way that we have an obligation of Mora Migdash Le'olam, it means you can't just move thousands of miles away and disregard the whole concept of Migdash because I don't want to violate anything. No. You should show an interest. You should be involved. You should try as best as you can to show how much you appreciate Makom HaMikdash. That is part of the mitzvah of Mora HaMikdash, that when you are there, you should act in a certain way. When we are in the presence of our parents, we should behave accordingly. And that perhaps is what is meant here. So, this is something that we need to keep in mind. I think sometimes when we read the articles about people who are involved in going up to the Har HaBayis or not, we get lost in the politics of it, but we don't realize there is a very firm ground that they stand on, and there is a very good reason why people are considering this as a very important endeavor to be involved with. This is not politics. This is something that is a very important halachic discussion. So let us think about this as follows. Even for those who consider it to be a very important mission, to be frequenting the Har HaBayis, to be going as often as they can, they need to keep in mind what the Rambam writes in Hilchos Beis HaBechira. That is where the Rambam outlines how one is supposed to behave in a Beis HaMikdash, what should be done in a Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam here, I'm sorry, it says Aleph and Aleph. There is no hidden meaning behind that. It's just a mistake. So the Rambam says here in number Aleph 2, in Hilchos Beis HaBechira, the seventh parak, Kol HaNichnas La'azara, Yahalech Ben Nachas, B'makom Shemutu Lo Lihikanes L'Sham. Person has to be careful to go in the places where they are allowed to go. But when doing so, Mahalech Be'ema Uviyira Uvira'ada. Person needs to be careful that they go with a sense of awe and humility, with a sense of seriousness. Shenemar bebeis Elokim nahalech beragish. And this is something that bothers me. Sometimes when we see the videos of groups that go up to the Har HaBayis, you don't get the sense that they are always going with such humility and such awe and such seriousness, understanding the severity of the place, of the experience that they're about to have, understanding the consequence of doing the wrong thing in this place. And that's something that always needs to be kept in mind, whether you think it's the right thing or potentially the wrong thing to do. If you are one of those people that feel it's important to be frequenting the Har HaBayis, you need to keep the words of the Rambam in mind, that we need to go with a certain attitude, with a certain perspective, with a certain understanding of what it is to be in the presence of the Shekhinah. For all those who consider going on to the Har HaBayis, the most important thing to keep in mind is that one has to be tahor, that one has to be pure when doing so, and you need to go to a mikveh. It has to be a kosher mikveh, not just a kosher mikveh. You need to make a bracha, many say, because you're doing a tefillah that's for the sake of going on to the Har HaBayis. Many assume that as a result of that, you would probably have to make a bracha when doing so. So now let's get into the actual discussion. whether or not this is something that would be permissible or potentially something that should be frowned upon. The first question that we need to consider is, do we assume that the Harabayis retains its status of Kedusha even after the Churban Beis HaMikdash? Beis HaMikdash was destroyed so many years ago, and I would have assumed that our lives moved on and we don't have to worry about this any longer. But let's discuss whether or not there is a retention of Kedusha in the Makam HaMikdash even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Look here in number Beis, where the Rambam discusses this at length. Kedusha Rishona Shekidish Shlomo as Beis HaMikdash. The first kibush that Shlomo HaMelech was Mekadesh, the Beis HaMikdash and Yerushalayim. As we know, David HaMelech wished in his entire life, in his entire experience, to build the Beis HaMikdash. And he was doing everything he could to try and bring that to a reality. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him, Dam Larov Shafachta. David HaMelech, I appreciate your intention, I appreciate your wishes, and I would love for you to build the Beis HaMikdash, but the problem is your hands have been involved in Milchama, which is an interesting point, because after all, what kind of Milchama was he involved in? A Milchama's mitzvah. He was fighting off the enemies of the Jewish people. He was conquering the land of Israel. I would have said that that should not disqualify a person. Those are very holy hands. Which really leads to another discussion, which is not for today, maybe for another time. There is a major discussion about, the Gemara says that a kohen shehareges hanefesh lo yisa es kapav. It says that a kohen who is involved in murder is not allowed to duchen. He's not allowed to do nesias kapayim. So there's a major contemporary discussion. What would you say about a chayal? You have many soldiers in the army who unfortunately sometimes have to use their firearms to kill someone, and it's a tragedy anytime anyone's life is lost, even when it's fighting against an enemy. Nobody wants to be involved in bloodshed. So the question is whether or not that person would be disqualified from doing the Nesias Kapayim. Now here in America, you'll say it's not such a big deal. We only do Nesias Kapayim a few times a year, but in Israel, it's an embarrassment. Imagine you're going to have a kohen who everybody knows is a kohen, and every single day when he comes to shul, he's never allowed to be involved in the mitzvah of Nesias Kapayim. It's very uncomfortable. It's a difficult question. So this is discussed by Rabbi Avadia. Rabbi Soloveitchik had what to say about it. Rabbi Soloveitchik actually felt in the other direction. He felt that it was something that is not appropriate, that a kohen should not duchen. Many other of his contemporaries disagreed. Anyway, it was a major discussion. I was once giving a shiur about it, and I didn't want to say the conclusion because I was afraid, well, what if a kohen in Israel is going to listen? He's going to think that, you know, this is the bottom line. So I said, it's a major discussion. Rabbi Moshe feels it's mutter. Rabbi Avadia feels it's okay. And I said, Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that it was improper, so I just left it off a loose question. So this guy sends me an email that he tells me that he is from, I think he was in the Tzanchanim, and he said that he is a sharpshooter. And he said that, he's like, I'm not sure if you're familiar, but he says that every time there's a sharpshooter who's sent to do any job in the army, there's always two people who are involved in that. You have the spotter and the shooter. Because this has to be done so quickly, the shooter is not going to be able to focus exactly on the target in such a short period of time, so quickly. So the spotter has to do all of the background work, he has to set everything up, and the shooter just pulls the trigger. So he said, I am not the shooter, I am the spotter, and I am a kohen. And he says, I was very disheartened when I heard your shiur, but I felt in a certain sense that I'm not the one who's doing the act of murder, I'm just helping somebody else do it. So would that disqualify me as well? And I was amazed by the shiloh. I was amazed. It's a fascinating discussion to have, something to think about. But the Rambam says over here that ultimately David HaMelech was disqualified from building a Beis HaMikdash. And it was given over in the hands of Shlomo HaMelech. And the Rambam says, Lefikach, makriven karbanos af halpi she'en sham bayis banui. The Rambam says that he believes that this was an everlasting, an eternal Kedusha. When Shlomo HaMelech infused the Makam HaMikdash with Kedusha by building the Beis HaMikdash, this is something that lasted forever, for all eternity, even when there is no bayis banui. Theoretically, says the Rambam, were we to have the opportunity to offer a carbon today, we would be allowed to go on the Harabais and do so. And the Rambam then gets poetic in the end. You can read the whole thing on your own, but the Rambam in the last two lines says, why is it that I say that the Kedusha of the Harabais is relevant even today? There's no Beis HaMikdash, there are no Karbanos, nobody's going there to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why should that be the case? Says the Rambam, the reason why is because the Shechina is what infused the Makam HaMikdash with its sanctity. And Shechina eina betela li'olam. You cannot get rid of the Shechina. You can destroy the house, you can destroy the Jewish people, you can throw them out of the land of Israel, but you cannot destroy the Shechina per se. And therefore the Rambam says, even when the Beis HaMikdash is no longer functioning, we still assume that the Makam HaMikdash retains its Kedusha. That is the opinion of the Rambam. As often we find the case, the Ravid takes the Rambam on here head on, and he writes almost disrespectfully, as sometimes you find, I mean, this is the way the Ravid and the Rambam corresponded with each other, but the Ravid writes over here, Amar Avram, he says, in my opinion, his name was Avram, so he says, my comment, Mr. Avram, was, Svaras Atzmo, he said, I think this opinion of the Rambam is totally inaccurate. V'lo yadati minayelo, as far as I'm concerned, he says, the Rambam made this up. There is no source that points to this psak of the Rambam. And the Ravid says, I think he is completely mistaken. When there's no Beis HaMikdash, there is no Kedusha on the Har HaBayis. And I would say, writes the Ravid, that the Rambam got it all wrong. And I don't agree at all with what he's saying. So it takes the Ravid to take on the Rambam like that. But that is what we find. That is the comment of the Ravid. Now, there was a major debate in the Rishonim. How do you interpret the objection of the Ravid? What does he mean when he says the Rambam is wrong? Does he mean the Rambam is categorically wrong and there is absolutely no Kedusha once the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed? Or do we assume that the Rambam is partially wrong? What does partially wrong mean? Either he's right or he's wrong. Partially wrong means there is a Kedusha that is retained even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, but there would be no Chiyuv Kares Mizman Hazeh. That's all the Ravid disagrees with. It's a lower level of Kedusha than it was at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, but the status of sanctity is still there. The holiness is still there. It retains its Kedusha. It has not been lost with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So that is a very fundamental discussion in the opinion of the Ravid, and how do we interpret what the Ravid actually meant when he objected to this opinion of the Rambam. How do we paskin? A very consequential dispute here. A very substantive machlokas. Do you believe, number one, like the Rambam, that there is a Kedusha entirely, like it was in the time of the Beis HaMikdash? Do you believe in the Ravid that it's been lost or it's been partially lost? How do we paskin? So you look in the Magen Avram and Hilchas Tisha B'Av, Tavkuf Samach Aleph. The reason why it's there is because it's talking about halachas of visiting Yerushalayim, Kriya, Churban. So there the Magen Avram throws in that nowadays if somebody goes into the Makam HaMikdash, you would be Chayiv Kares, because we believe that the Rambam is correct. That Kitsha Liyasid Lavo, that the Kedusha is there for all eternity, it has not left, and this is something that we need to be mindful of. We need to think about it, because it is something that is very relevant even in our generation. And that is the psak of the Magen Avram. Now it so happens that there was a word out there that in the days of the Me'iri, right, I'm sure many of us have heard of the Me'iri, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, in the days of the Me'iri, it was said that there were many Jews who used to frequent the Har HaBayis. So you ask yourself, how did they do that? The Me'iri is in some way a student of the Rambam. He followed many of the psakim of the Rambam, you find. He defends the Rambam sometimes, he explains the Rambam every so often. So how is it that in the days of the Me'iri they went on to the Har HaBayis? And there's such a shmua out there that the Jews who lived there. So this is addressed by many poskim, and they say, just because there were Jews who lived in Yerushalayim at the time doesn't mean that they were learned Jews. And just because there were Jews who went to the Har HaBayis doesn't mean that it was sanctioned, doesn't mean that it was the right thing to do. They decided on their own to excitedly go to the Har HaBayis, but maybe they were wrong. So we can't take any example from the stories that we've heard of Jews going up to the Har HaBayis. And in fact, the Ramban writes a letter about his trip to Yerushalayim. You know what the Ramban says? Anyone ever saw this letter? The Ramban writes, it's an amazing letter. You know, you think the glorious days of Yerushalayim. The Ramban says, I worked so hard to get myself to Yerushalayim, right? We've all heard of the Ramban Shul. There's a reason why it's called the Ramban Shul, because he really went through a lot of difficulty to get himself to Yerushalayim. And he says, I got there, and there were just like two or three religious Jews there, and they were davening in their own house, and I had to encourage them, you know, maybe we should make a shul. Maybe it would be nice if a couple of Jews got together and davened all as a tzibur. And this was something that he had to encourage them to do. So if the Ramban couldn't even find a minyan, and it was a major feat when he finally got a couple of Jews together and they davened and they laned and they had an opportunity to celebrate a Yom Tov together or a Shabbos, then how can we take any example for what the Jews were doing in the days of the Rishonim? The Jews weren't even davening in the days of the Rishonim. The Jews who lived in Yerushalayim, they didn't even have a minyan. So that really would not be such a conclusive proof. You know, there's a story that's told about Moses Montefiore when he went in the 1800s. He was one of the great philanthropists in England. He was a relative of the Rothschild family, and then he became very, very successful on his own. And he was so successful that he spent all of his time not so much in business any longer, but really supporting the Jewish community. And he rebuilt many, many different towns in Yerushalayim. He rebuilt Hebron. He was involved in Tzfat and Tiberia after the terrible devastation there. And he was a major personality. So we know that he visited Eretz Yisrael a number of times. And each trip that he made, he went to a different part of the country. But on one occasion, he was so excited to come to Yerushalayim, and he made an arrangement that he should visit the Har HaBayis. Now, all hell broke loose when he did that, because all the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim went crazy. Oh, he did the right thing, the wrong thing, and they were all fighting the same way we fight today. Nothing changed. And there were harems back and forth. So the son of the Nesivos was Rabbi Yaakov Milisa. His son was Rabbi Moshe Yosef Milisa, who lived in Yerushalayim at the time. He took out a shofar, he put him in Cheirem. How can Moshe Montefiore go up to the Har HaBayis? We all know you're not allowed to. Kitsha la'asid lavo, we paskin like the Rambam. Look at the Magen Avram, how can he do such a thing? And he puts him in Cheirem. Now Moshe Montefiore was an Orthodox Jew. He was a God-fearing Jew. He wanted to do the right thing, and he's shocked. He doesn't know what to do with himself. And he starts complaining to the other rabbis in Yerushalayim. What happened? I went to the Har HaBayis because I thought that that was the right thing to do. Never did I dream in a million years I would end up in Cheirem. And basically they all put Rabbi Moshe Yosef Milisa in Cheirem, and they said his Cheirem doesn't mean anything, we're going to Cheirem him back. So it was an interesting time, but basically this was the major dispute at the time, and this is something that has come up over the many, many generations, many different times, about how do we paskin, what is the right thing to do, and what perhaps would be an inappropriate thing to do. Rav Kook, who I find fascinating, I mean for a million and one reasons, but Rav Kook, what I find fascinating about this discussion is, all the people who go up to the Har HaBayis are major followers of Rav Kook in everything in life. Right? Is it safe to say? Probably most of them. And Rav Kook was so adamant that it's the wrong thing to do. I find it so interesting. It's like almost the same as in our community, that we all are students of the Rav. But when the Rav said something that we don't fully appreciate, so we just seem to ignore him. For example, Yom HaShoah. The Rav was so adamant that we should not commemorate Yom HaShoah. It's inappropriate. The Rav said this every year, and he wrote about it. He was not quiet about his feelings, not that he didn't appreciate the devastation of the Holocaust, of course he did, but he said this is such a mega tragedy, this should take over Tisha B'Av. This should be our Tisha B'Av. This is exactly what we should think about on Tisha B'Av, and there's no reason to put another day on the calendar. Now, how did it happen? Good question, but I find it fascinating that the major community in America who actually commemorate Yom HaShoah are the followers of the Rav, which is exactly what he said not to do. It's interesting. So here, again, it's not a condemnation, it's just interesting how things morph, how they come to be. So here, Rav Kook, who was really the leader of so many of the Dati Leumi community in Israel, Rav Kook is the one who was the first one out in the forefront saying that this is a terrible thing to do. And Rav Kook actually used to put out a cruise, he used to put out a public letter before the Yomim Tovim, because he knew that people on Yom Tov like to come to Yerushalayim more so than at other times during the year. And Rav Kook warned everybody that we're all Tameh and we don't have a right to go to the Makom HaMikdash, and he feels it's inappropriate and there are so many terrible things that can happen as a result of not doing this properly. And Rav Kook was adamant that this is a practice that should not be done. Even if we do adopt the opinion of the Rambam, even if we do say that it is Kidsha Liyasid Lavo, that the Kedusha of the Har HaBayis is something that is eternal, even if we do say that that is the correct position, that being the case, we have to ask ourselves, what exactly are the measurements of the Har HaBayis? If you look in a Mishnah in Maseches Midos, one of the Mishnayos, just a little plug here, I don't know if anyone discussed here about the Mishnah Yomi that's starting today. Did we talked about it? So it was really a big thrill in our shul. A lot of people have taken it on. It's exciting. So Mishnah and Midos, I don't know how often you have a chance to get across that Mishnah, but if you learn Mishnah Yomi, I guess in 5 years from now you'll get there. So in Mishnayos Midos, the Mishnah tells us that the parameter of the dimensions of the Har HaBayis were 500 by 500 amos. Now, if you know a little bit of mathematics and you go to the Har HaBayis, you'll see it is not at all commensurate with those numbers. Obviously, it's not 500 by 500. The space, the surface area of the Har HaBayis is much larger than 500 by 500 amos. So how do you explain that? What happened? So the answer is, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Baba Basra that in the days of Hurdus, Herod decided to do a major expansion of the Har HaBayis. And Herod decided that he should not only expand the Har HaBayis, but he should expand the Beis HaMikdash. So much so that the Gemara tells us that the second Beis HaMikdash was so much more exquisite than the first Beis HaMikdash because of all of the contributions that Herod had put into it and all of the infrastructure that was infused into the second Beis HaMikdash. That being the case, now that the Har HaBayis was extended, you have to ask yourself, does that now take on the status of Harabayis? Does that happen automatically? Just because you extend the wall and you now say, you declare that the Harabayis is larger than we would have thought, does that now mean that everything takes on the reality of Harabayis and we have to keep all the restrictions by all of this new expanded area, or potentially not? So there's a Mishnah Maseches Shuos, let's look at number 8, where the Mishnah says that extensions don't happen by themselves. There are a number of critical components that are necessary to have an extension of the Beis HaMikdash. So see, for example, the Mishnah says, Ein mosifin al ha'ir ve'al ha'azaros. Look carefully at what is mentioned here in the Mishnah. Ein mosifin al ha'ir ve'al ha'azaros. If you want to add on to the city of Yerushalayim, or you want to add on to the Azara, which is the Beis HaMikdash proper, the way to do that is, you need to have a Melech, you need to have a Navi, you need to have the Urim V'tumim, you need to have a Sanhedrin, Shel Shivim V'yachad, you need to have Karbanos, you need to sing Shira, a whole bunch of things. You have a whole procedure that you need to follow in order for that to take effect. So, because politically you decided that we need more room in Yerushalayim and now we're going to extend the border and redirect where the lines are going to be drawn, that doesn't necessarily mean that halachically it's going to be Yerushalayim. And because you decide that the Beis HaMikdash is not big enough, and now we need to expand where the walls of the Beis HaMikdash are going to be built, that doesn't necessarily mean that it takes on the Kedusha. You need all of these components. Now, notice, one of the things that is left out here is Harabayis. So the Mishnah says there are a number of things that critical components that we need to add on to Yerushalayim or to add on to the Azara, but it doesn't say that you need that to add on to the surface area of the Harabayis. And that is a major point of debate. Should we assume that the extension that Herod made onto the Harabayis is something that automatically stuck, and now that takes on the property of Harabayis for all halachos that are relevant to that space? Or do you say no? Now you'll ask, what difference does it make? It makes a major difference, because different sections of the Harabayis have different regulations and different restrictions. As we know, there are different halachos that govern the various parts of the surface area of the Harabayis. There is Machane Leviya, and then there is what we refer to as Machane Shechina. Machane Leviya is like the secondary area. Machane Shechina is where there's a more intense level of Kedusha, a more intense level of sanctity. And there are different halachas that govern each one of those locations. Different people who are Tamei in different ways are allowed to go to a certain place and are not allowed to go to a different. So as we know, all of us are considered to be Tamei Meis. We are all considered to be in somewhat defiled. And that's something that we can only shake off by having Parah Aduma, which unfortunately we don't have. So how can anyone go on to the Harabayis? Nobody has a Parah Aduma. So the answer is that a Tamei Meis, the Psukim say, somebody who is Tamei, who is defiled because they came in contact with a dead body, is allowed to go onto the Harabayis perimeter, into the Machane Leviya, but they're not allowed to go into the middle part, which is the Machane Shechina, which is the more intensive space of Kedusha. How do we know that? The Gemara learns that from Moshe Rabbeinu. After all, Moshe Rabbeinu, all the years in the Midbar, was traveling in the middle of the camp. That's where the Mishkan was. That's where Moshe Rabbeinu was found. And he was traveling with the bones of Yosef the entire time. How can he do that? How can he bring the bones of Yosef? I'm sorry, not in the inside. How can Moshe Rabbeinu bring the bones of Yosef along? The Gemara says, because in the outer perimeter, you're allowed to have a Tamei Meis. It's not a problem. It's only in the Machane Shechina itself, in the Mishkan proper, in the Beis HaMikdash itself, you're not allowed to have someone who's a Tamei Meis. So as we know, there are different laws that govern different parts of the perimeter of the Beis HaMikdash, of the different locations, and that is something that we need to think about. Now, to get rid of a Tumah HaYotza Alav Migufo, if somebody has an emission, either a man or a woman who has an emission from their body which would make them impure, that is something that we can get rid of by going to the mikvah. But again, that has to be done by going to a mikvah kshera. It has to be something that is done very carefully, the same way a mikvah for tfilas nida is something that we take very seriously and is done very carefully. So too, this is something that we're very careful about as well. Anyway, this is some of the discussion regarding this issue about going on to the Harabayis. I see we're already almost out of time. Henry told me 1.5 to 2 hours. I know you can stay longer. I'm not sure everybody else wants to. But let's look at a comment of the Sefer Charedim where he quotes a letter of the Rambam. The Rambam writes here, Sam actually said I should talk until everyone falls asleep. So you can just fall asleep and then I'll stop. So the Sefer Charedim writes, in the name of the Rambam, that the Rambam actually documented when he came to Yerushalayim. And in fact, I just find this so moving. The Rambam writes that he told his family that from here on in, this day is considered a familial holiday. Because this was the day that I came to Yerushalayim. Imagine if that's the message we gave over to our children. Now, we don't give over that message because we go to Yerushalayim so often. But imagine if we told our children, this is a day to celebrate because last year, I actually had the schus, I had the merit of being in Yerushalayim. And that's not something that any of us should take for granted. So the Rambam here writes, let's read it together. B'yom shlishi b'shabbos arba yamim liyerach mar cheshvan. It sounds like I'm reading a ksuba, I know. So the Rambam says that was the date. Shnas arba alafim tshameos. Shisha ve'esrim liyitzira yatsanu me'ako. We left the city of Akko. Lalos liyushalayim tachas sakana. We endangered our lives to go and visit Yerushalayim. V'nechnasti l'bayis ha'gadol v'ha'kadosh. And the Rambam says, I went into, you can read the words, what does it say? I went into the bayis ha'gadol v'ha'kadosh. V'hispalalti bo, and I davened in the bayis ha'gadol v'ha'kadosh. U'shnei yamim ha'elu, and these 2 days, shem shishi u'chi b'mar cheshvan nadarti, I made a promise, Shieli kmo yamtiv, that these are going to be celebratory days. These are going to be yamim tovim in my family. Hakel yazreni al hakala, Kadosh Baruch Hu, help me viyukumli nidrish la Hashem ashalem. And I hope that next year I'll be able to celebrate this great day of celebration, the day that I had the schus of coming to Yerushalayim. Kishem shazachisi li spalaba b'churbana, the same way that I had the great privilege of davening in the Bayis HaGadol HaKadosh, when it was destroyed, Kach Ere Ani V'chol Yisrael B'Nachamasa B'mher V'Yameinu Amen. And the Rambam says that he hopes he'll have the opportunity to daven in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, what does that say? It seems very clear that the Rambam violated his own opinion. After all, Rambam, you told us, Kitshali Asad Lavo. So how could it be that you went onto the Har HaBayis and you davened in the Bayis HaGadol HaKadosh? This was something that raised many eyebrows by the Achronim. How is it possible that the Rambam did this? Well, it must be. At the day, in the times of the Rambam, there was no Beis HaMikdash. So what does he mean? He went to the Bayis HaGadol VaHaKadosh. There is no Bayis HaGadol VaHaKadosh. It's not there. So what is he referring to? So many Achronim say, well, first of all, if the Rambam is the one who objects to visiting the Har HaBayis because he believes that there is a Kedusha that is still there, then how did he go in the first place? And second of all, what does he mean that he went to this great edifice, to this great Bayis HaGadol VaHaKadosh? It must be that there was a shul that was very close to the Har HaBayis. And the Rambam was overwhelmed with joy that he had the opportunity to daven in a shul in Yerushalayim. And it must be that he's asking, the same way I had the opportunity to daven in Yerushalayim b'churbana, I hope I'll have the opportunity someday to daven in Yerushalayim b'binyana. And this is what we all hope for. Rav Soloveitchik writes so beautifully, I'll close with this comment. There are two very fundamental mountains in Jewish history. And as we know, those two mountains are Har Sinai and the Har HaBayis, Har Moriah. Rav Soloveitchik writes that there's a major distinction between both of these. The Torah says in Parashas Yisro, Bimshoch Hayovel, Hema Yalu Bahar. We know that while HaKadosh Baruch Hu was there, giving us the Torah hovering over the mountain, we were not allowed to come close. And there was a cheirem against anybody who came too close, who went where they were not supposed to go. But immediately after the experience of Har Sinai, that mountain became meaningless. Everyone was allowed to go up, everyone was allowed to do whatever they wanted around Har Sinai. And yet Har Moriah is something that is a Kedusha that the Rambam writes is everlasting. Why is there a distinction? I would have said that Har Sinai is something that should have been a Kedusha that lasts forever. After all, God spoke to us at Har Sinai. That's where we became the Am Hashem, the Am HaNivchar. Why is that less significant than Har Moriah? And explains Rav Soloveitchik, the difference between these two is who infused them with Kedusha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to Har Sinai, and as a result of his presence, the whole mountain was elevated. But once the Ribono Shel Olam left, that experience was over. Har Moriah is something that became Kadosh because for thousands of years, Jews have invested in the Kedusha of Har Moriah. Jews gave up so much to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Har Moriah, on the Har HaBayis. And that is something that is a Kedusha that will never wane, that will never dissipate. Because when we infuse of ourselves to make something a reality, that has so much more meaning than something that comes by itself. There's a fascinating comment in the Shemi Shmuel where he writes, that there's a major difference between Havdalah that we make after Yom Tov and Havdalah that we make on Matzoi Shabbos. So it's Sunday morning today, and we all made Havdalah last night, and we know that after Shabbos, you smell the besamim. But yet, after the experience of Yom Tov, we do say Hamavdim and Kodesh Lechol, but we leave out that bracha of the besamim. Why is that? What is the difference? And he quotes from the Ramban. It's not exactly what the Ramban says. The Ramban doesn't explain what he means, but the Shem Yishmuel explains that this is what he had in mind. And the answer is, because the sanctity of Shabbos, the Gemara says, Shabbos is kaviya v'kaima. Shabbos comes every week, whether we like it or not, whether we prepare for Shabbos or not, whether we're ready for Shabbos or not, Shabbos will be here. Yom Tov, on the other hand, the Gemara says, Mekadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. We are the ones who need to infuse the Yom Tov with its Kedusha. It won't happen by itself. Yom Tov only becomes a sanctified and holy day if we are Mekadesh the Chodesh. And only then does it trigger in motion what's going to happen a week or 2 weeks later with the celebration of Sukkot and the celebration of Pesach. The Ritva writes, what if the Beis Din, for whatever reason, did not have an opportunity to be Mekadesh the Chodesh? For whatever reason, the Ritva writes, I believe in Maseches Chulin, there would be no Yom Tov. What does that mean? There would be no Pesach, no Sukkot? How could it be? Because it's all Tali, it's all dependent on our infusion of Kedusha. Well, when that happens, writes the Shem Yishmuel, Shabbos, easy come, easy go. After Shabbos is over, we lose that Neshama Yisera, and we need to smell the Besamim to appease ourselves. Writes the Shem Yishmuel after Yom Tov, which we invested to create the Kedusha, which we infused with everything that it's about. After Yom Tov is over, that experience is never lost. We don't need to smell the besamim because everything that was created through that experience of having a Yom Tov and elevating ourselves through our own infusion of sanctity is something that will not leave after Yom Tov is over. And that's something we can think about. As we aspire and as we yearn and we daven every day, B'sechazena einenu b'shuvcha l'tzion b'rachamim, b'li Yerushalayim ircha b'rachamim tashuv. And I would say that today, this means more than perhaps it has meant for many of us in a long time. Because we yearn and we're interested and we're excited to have the opportunity to go back to Eretz Yisrael, to celebrate Yerushalayim once again, to see the Beis HaMikdash b'binyana. We hope it will happen in our time, in our day. But it's an opportunity for us to think about the fact that that sanctity was created by our infusion. It was something that over so many years Jews have sacrificed for. Avraham Avinu was the one who started it by giving of himself, by giving of Yitzchak. The Avos all gave of themselves for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is why the Kedusha of the Har HaBayis is something that is potentially there even long beyond the days of a Beis HaMikdash. It's something that we created. It's something that we look forward to enjoying. And it's something that we pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu every day that we'll have the schus, that we'll have the opportunity to once again experience in our lifetime. I wish everyone a most meaningful day. Thank you again all for coming, and enjoy your day off.